Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography today. Out of the Frame acknowledges the people of the Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation, on whose unceded lands we record each episode from. We respectfully acknowledge ancestors and elders, past and present. It was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. Welcome back to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography this year in 2025. I'm really excited to present you a range of different artists working in and around photography, and our conversations are really wide-ranging. Thanks so much for listening, and please make sure you review, share, and like us wherever you get your podcasts. My guest today is Matt Dunn, who is an artist whose work explores Australia's environment as a product of colonial legacy. Using photography and research as a basis, he develops publications, installations, and education programs that engage wide-ranging and diverse audiences to deepen their connection to the world around them. Trained as a teacher, Matt owns and operates Tall Poppy Press, a publishing imprint dedicated to showcasing Australian artists. He has also written about photography widely, reviewing many photo books and producing critical texts for exhibitions and galleries. Finally, Matt believes in sharing knowledge and cheerleading for fellow creatives. In 2023, Matt was diagnosed with autism and is still working out what that means. He's lived in rural Australia, the UK, and the Amazon, and makes excellent lasagna, and he reads about 60 books a year. A little bit about Tall Poppy Press. Tall Poppy Press is a Melbourne-based publishing imprint focused on bringing Australian art to the world. They make books that are excellent, playful, and creative. Tall Poppy Press books are by Australian artists or collaborations between Australians and non-Australian artists. They make things somewhere between a coffee table book and a zine, and they like imperfection, texture, and things that feel unusual. Tall Poppy Press believe making a book is a chance for a new act of creativity. Their latest book, Milk Teeth, is out now. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Pia.
Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. I thought we'd just jump straight in. You do a lot of things. You take photos, you write about photography, and you make and publish books. Can you tell us how it all started? And I guess the story of how you got to what you're doing now.
Sure. I mean, the short version of the story is when I was 21, I started working as a high school teacher in rural Victoria. And I had a lot of time on my hands, so I would go on really long walks, you know, sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 hour walks. And I started to feel like I want to share with people back home what I'm seeing. And at the same time as I was doing that, for the first time in my life, I started spending a bit of time on social media, which was Tumblr at the time. And the more I spent there, the more I thought, oh, I think I can probably take a picture and share it with people. I think what I'm seeing people do is something that I'd like to have a go at. So that was sort of the start of taking pictures, being somewhere new, being outdoors a lot, and then just wanting to share it online and share it with people in my life. I'm sort of someone that's like always looking for ways to participate in something. You know, I often come to like communities and topics and hobbies through the internet first, and then wanting to really expand how I participate. So early on in my journey as someone who came to art later in life, you know, I was reading interviews online, I was listening to podcasts and watching videos. And I have a background as a writer, like my uni degree's in literature, so you have to write a lot in that degree. And I just saw opportunities to sort of send an email to places like the Heavy Collective and say, hey, you know, I'd love to like review a book. At the same time, as I made more friends, we would sort of share ideas about, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have a website that would interview people about this or talk about that? And I just found enough people that were like, hey, I'll do that with you, where I sort of was able to start something with a friend. So, for example, in 2018, my friend Barney and I ran This on That, which was a website where we interviewed photographers about something other than photography. And after about a year, we sort of felt, hey, we've had our fun.
Yeah.
But doing that with someone else meant the next thing I did, which was called Tending to the Garden, which isn't up anymore, where I would write about Australian photography or interview people about sort of art and the environment. I just felt like it was easier. I didn't need to sort of partner with someone anymore.
Mm.
So I guess like to maybe make that slightly annoying story a bit shorter, like I was sort of doing my own thing and wanted to find more ways to like connect with more people, and writing was just a really easy way to do that, partially because I feel comfortable with it, but partially because I found a few people that were keen. And again, you know, getting into publishing, which we'll probably talk more about later, was again just another way to like increase my participation in, you know, the art world.
Okay. When did you take photos then? Like, has that been something right from, I don't know, like that, just from that period of moving to rural Victoria or before then?
Just from that part.
Yeah, wow. Can I just, because I live in regional Vic.
Yeah.
Can I ask where in rural Vic that you were?
Yeah, so I started in Mildura. So I lived in Mildura for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Warrnambool for 1 year. But I love Mildura and I still spend a lot of time in that sort of riverina, arid area. Warrnambool is a very beautiful place, but I didn't really feel very comfortable.
It's a very different landscape too.
It is a very different landscape and it's a great landscape. But, you know, the school I was working at and the community that I met through that, I just didn't really want to stay there in the long term.
Yeah. And where's home?
Home's definitely Melbourne. Like I'm someone that's lived around, you know, I've lived in rural Victoria, I've lived in the UK, I've lived in Canberra. But I grew up in Melbourne and I live here now and I'll probably live here for much, much longer.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I don't know. But I find home, like I don't know. When I move places, it's not too hard to find a sense of like connection.
Yeah. No, you just mentioned it. That's why I was trying to work out who are you trying to tell about these long walks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there is a really interesting consciousness of not being in a town or a city, and Melbourne is a major city now, but, you know, I feel like regional and rural Victoria have a very particular kind of identity and a very particular kind of sensitivity to it. So,
and a really different like public space, like the things that you find wandering around the back blocks of like grape farms are very different to what people leave in the back blocks of the city. But, you know, one of the reasons I moved so far away was, you know, I was sort of graduating from uni and I wanted to like, I was just ready to do something different. And a lot of my friends that I'd grown up with and who I like loved and still love very dearly, they weren't quite ready to do that yet. Like a lot of them were extending their study and stuff like that. And so I sort of wanted to go far away and just like try and be a slightly different person.
Yeah.
Cool. Without needing to kind of like explain that or show like the kind of work in progress to my family or friends. But the photos were definitely a way of being like, look how interesting this place is. Like a place that many people I know won't visit at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Is like kind of beautiful and unusual in ways that I found really fascinating. I remember walking along, there's this sort of dry lake bed where if it rains enough, it sort of fills up so that the town doesn't flood. And in the middle of the dried lake bed, there's sort of like this old brick structure and somebody just graffitied like "social workers saved my life." And it's, you sort of are there and you're thinking, who the hell walked out, got their feet muddy as I was doing, to send this really beautiful and kind of heartbreaking message that will probably be seen by like 5 people.
Yeah.
And I found that really poignant. I was sort of like, isn't that kind of
It's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. also like.
And human.
Yeah, totally. And also, you know, you got the sunset and you got the mud flat and you got the building. And it's sort of like, yeah, only someone who's looking to kill time by just walking themselves as far as they could go would ever see this.
Yeah, wow. There's a quote that I read of yours online that you said a few years ago.
Mm.
I'm interested in not just the story but the grey areas, the things we can't quite understand but know are there. And it feels like that story that you just mentioned sits in that, you know.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about that kind of that interest or that sensibility that you feel kind of drawn to?
Sure. I mean, I think probably some useful context is a lot of the like projects that I've made and finished, they sort of start with like a fairly clear grain of truth. Like I might be following an existing story or something that is happening like out in the real world. And I approach that like a little bit more like an artist. So I'm not trying to be a journalist. I'm trying to find the truth or share like a, you know, something that's like a true crime podcast where I sort of really go through things as a narrator. But what I am trying to do and how it relates to that quote is I'm trying to find something that is happening that kind of allows me to just go down multiple rabbit holes along the way. And each of those rabbit holes is usually like quite an unresolved thing. So, for example, one of the first things I finished was called Patterson's Curse, and it was sort of about, I guess, like male aggression and the aftermath and just this sort of feeling of emptiness and shame that often comes when people have really explosive, aggressive moments in their life.
Okay.
And I guess the gray area there is sort of like, how are you supposed to feel about someone in your life who's had a blow up, who's been rude, been aggressive, maybe even been violent, and then now is feeling terrible about it? Are they sympathetic or not? And there's no answer to that question. But I just kind of like sitting in that space and trying to explore it visually. And, you know, there's rabbit holes of, you know, what does violence look like? I never photographed anyone doing anything, but I'd photograph like the aftermath of a really intense party or, you know, something frozen in a really uncomfortable way. And I was working a lot with some teenagers at the time, and like I would often photograph them and sort of use them as almost placeholders. So there was some of the gray areas, like, is this person that I'm looking at, have they done any of these things or are they just convenient stand-ins?
Or and victims I, even, like, you know, totally, all the other different
totally.
Various ways.
And I don't want to tell people. Like I want, you know, it's interesting more to me to people to kind of sit and think about those things.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you did a literature degree. I feel like there's a kind of literary not trope, what's it like, what's the word when you like use a certain technique in writing, like when they talk about that you're kind of like in a way doing visually in your both investigative kind of exploration of rabbit holes but then also that visual thing of like evidence and clues but a kind of really lateral way of thinking about a subject.
Yeah. And I think like for me, like I don't really, you know, before I was 21, I didn't really have any experience with visual art. Obviously I read a lot. I also listened to a lot of music. And there's a book that I often think about and it's in this book, the writer is a journalist. He was a journalist for Rolling Stone for a long time. And his older brothers both had really terrible lives. And one of them at a point was quite famous because he was the first person to be executed in the state of Utah when the death penalty was reinstated. And the book that he writes, this author, is sort of like, it's almost like an autobiography of his family where he's trying to imagine, what were my parents' lives like? What were my older brothers' lives like? What has made us who we are, where my life is so different and my older brother who's now in jail is doing this? And it sort of combines like elements of autobiography that are sort of factual, you know, where people were living, but also like a lot of speculation about like, well, how might this have affected my older brother when he was 6 years old? Like he hasn't told me this, but let me think about people I know and things that I know now that I'm older and look back on and try and sort of make these connections, because my memory is the author was like getting asked all the time, like, what's going on with your brother? Like, why is he doing this thing?
Yeah.
And the author's like, it's a great question. I don't know. Let me try and find out. But a lot of it's looking inwards and trying to make those connections, knowing that you don't have a complete set of information.
Yeah, I love that idea. I think that's a really active way of thinking about things and actually gives agency to the unknown.
Totally.
But also to that thing of going, there are multiple ways of understanding.
Yeah.
Like you always go back to that idea, I think, for me anyway, multiple perspectives, multiple voices. We never truly know the inside of anyone else's head.
No, not at all.
All those kind of things. And I think what's really fascinating is that idea of that gray area. For me, I probably talk about liminality, or I talk about in-betweenness, or not belonging, or belonging and not belonging. You know, those kind
of
this constant jostling between feeling comfortable and not feeling comfortable.
Totally.
And I think as we sort of said really early, it's really human. It's a really real struggle that we all do and mask and, you know, function. But I think as a visual, like to take that on as a kind of visual way of thinking about different subject matter is also really fascinating.
Yeah, and I think like something that maybe like plays into this a bit in my work is I like mixing different types of visual languages. So, for example, if you look at my work, you might see something like a really standard sort of landscape shot. And then the next image might be something where I've set up a backdrop in a studio and I've brought something from outside in. Mm. And then the next picture might be from an archive or me taking a picture of something in an archive. And then the next thing might be like a lifted newspaper article. And often what I'm trying to do is bring in all these different ways that something has kind of been written about or that I can see, and trying to put them next to each other as a way of getting at the big whole. So with Patterson's Curse, you know, I'm not following one person or one event or one family, but I'm trying to bring in like elements of what do you see in the street. And I remember like for a while I would like take pictures of really aggressive bumper stickers because I was sort of fascinated by like this sort of like like this really public standoffishness.
Oh my God, totally.
Yeah, where somebody would be like, you know, if you're tailgating me, like I'm going to pull over and like beat you up. And you just think like that's so fascinating that someone is so outwardly aggressive.
Yeah, there's a Looney Tunes thing that I remember always going past like, you know, patrol four-wheel drives that, you know, had the I don't know what the character is, with the two guns.
Oh, yeah.
Back off or whatever it was.
Like Coyote Sam or something.
Something like that. But, yeah, it's really interesting to see how people use slogans and statements in that environment. And we're constantly told, you know, be careful of road rage.
Yeah.
And, like, be, you know. But, yeah, wow.
And it's funny because I think, like, with photography, like, you can lift that. Like, you recontextualize it. So like when you see a bumper sticker, like maybe it's funny, maybe it's silly, or someone's wearing a t-shirt that says something kind of dumb and you see it as you walk past, you think, yeah, it's kind of silly. But then if you photograph it, you can kind of like take it out of that context and give it, it allows you to kind of like talk to something differently. Like I don't feel threatened when someone's got a silly bumper sticker on.
No.
I feel it's kind of dumb. But if I take a picture of it and put it in a different context, it sort of starts to read as like, maybe this person is kind of a threatening presence.
Yeah, interesting.
But that's not the feeling.
But it's fictional though too.
100%.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that person.
Yeah, of course.
And as I said, I don't actually have that reaction when I walk past.
Yeah.
I always think like, honestly, it almost makes me laugh. Like it's so silly.
But I think that's right though. I think we have to, you know, especially in like for what you're saying with Patterson's Curse, you know, consider all the factors, right? That's kind of what you're doing. You're kind of going, well, this is you're painting the picture of the society. And I think, look, I'd love to now move to talk about the Killing Sink, because I feel like these are the really strong links that you're doing in that work, you know, that idea of photographing things out in the environment but then also bringing outside things. I'm sort of thinking there's a particular image you have of I think it's a rabbit trap or
it's a dog trap.
A dog trap, yeah. Obviously a legal one, but that you've brought into the studio. And so, you know, that work is around the deliberate killing of wedge-tailed eagles in Victoria, and you published a book and you've exhibited it quite widely. Let's talk about that. How did that begin? Was that from the same kind of period that you were working in Regional Vic, or is it sort of
totally different?
Yeah, wow.
So I started working on that in 2018 or 19. And it started because, one, you know, I was looking for something to photograph and I wanted to try and photograph birds a little bit better. I thought, you know, bird photography is often very clinical, and I sort of was interested in more of a like expressionistic way of looking at birds. And around that time, I read an article in the paper, I was just killing time at work, about the court case that I eventually followed, where this farmhand had sort of, on his boss's instructions, killed, it turned out to be about 420 wedge-shot eagles.
Oh, my gosh. That's yeah. a lot.
It is. It's a huge amount, and in a 14-month period. So this is not a sort of, you know, over a lifetime.
Wow.
Yeah, a huge number of animals. And when I read that article, you know, I just felt miserable. You know, something about the idea that there was someone out there.
It's devastating. Like, it's just horrific to think, like, specifically targeting.
Totally. And you know, there's no shortage of tragedy in the world, but something about this one particular case, it just made me feel so low. And in a way, I couldn't get it out of my head.
Mm.
Whereas other things you read about, you know, they make you feel sad, but they don't have that Velcro. They don't always stick with you. So
I like that idea of Velcro.
Yeah, it's a good one. So initially what I was trying to do was almost like photograph eagles in the wild as sort of like a response and sort of think, well, you know, when I was reading interviews with these people or sort of summaries of what they said in court, you know, they were sort of describing these animals as annoying and pests and unpleasant. And I was sort of like, well, maybe I can photograph them in a way where they feel it's completely different, almost as like a sort of objection to that. But as I kept trying to find ways to photograph eagles, I also was interested in finding out, like, you know, do other people do this? Is this just a one-off crime? And, you know, I'd spend time looking in state library archives and finding like old pictures of people killing eagles, because it hasn't always been illegal in Australia. In fact, it was often encouraged by policy. And I got to a point where I sort of had gathered information about lots of places in Victoria in the last sort of decade where people had deliberately killed eagles, and old material from newspapers and old material from archives, and sort of wasn't just about this one court case anymore. That was like the impetus to sort of go, this happened once, but has it happened again? Has it happened more?
Yeah.
What's the sort of history of this crime? And I suppose like that just comes from that question we all ask ourselves when you read about something you really don't understand. You just can't stop asking why. And every time you get an answer to that question, it's not satisfying. Like, why do you do this? Well, we do it because we want to protect our sheep. Why do you value one lamb over one eagle? You know, and you get to a point, well, at least I got to a point where, you know, Australia has a long history of whatever's sellable is more important than anything else. So why is a sheep more important than an eagle? Well, we sell a sheep. You know, it doesn't really, to me, you know, no matter what I read or who I ask, it doesn't really get any deeper than that, you know.
Yeah.
I want to protect my income more than I care about anything else, even if there's no evidence that this particular eagle is harming any sheep.
Yeah.
It's more that I just want to make sure that I'm protected and my farm is good and I don't really care about anything else, which is a very unsatisfying answer. You know, when you're looking at it, you sort of think, that's just so shallow.
Yeah, and I also think too, it feels like a failure in the system, right? Like, it's like there must be other ways of being able to protect your livestock other than killing that many.
Which is exactly why it's illegal, you know, because there are. And more than that, you know, a number of pieces of research have looked at, do eagles actually threaten live sheep and lambs? And the answer is like very rarely. You know, they're carrion feeders. They prefer to eat dead things rather than hunt alive things.
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of roadkill in Australia.
I was going to say.
You know? Yeah. And that's often where, you know, if anyone's in Australia and wants to see eagles, I mean, just go find a dead kangaroo
come
and wait.
Come up the Calder Freeway.
Yeah.
We get to see, so we call them Bundrel.
Yeah.
because of the Indigenous language, and my daughter was taught that. So when from young, she's whenever we see an eagle, she yells out, "Oh, there's Bunjil."
Yeah.
And where we live, there's a few pairs.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's just the most beautiful thing to watch. But we see them always driving yeah. up along the freeway. And yeah.
And they're an interesting animal. I mean, they're one of the world's largest eagles. They're very widespread across Australia. You know, Australia being a relatively flat country, you can often see them sort of 5 or 10 kilometres away.
Mm.
They fly tremendously high. And
they're the most regal bird though. I mean, this yeah. is the thing. I mean, I just find yeah, incredible.
I find that so interesting where like you – something I didn't really get around to doing in the project because it was probably just going to be one element too many was, you know, there's a football team with the eagles as a mascot. There's a number yeah. of, you know, big wine brands like Wolf Blass have eagles. Some of these companies even used to have like captive eagles as like literal mascots. And
wow.
yeah, and like, you know.
God, people are weird.
They are weird. But to me, there's something really fascinating with predatory animals that they are often used for like coat of arms and coins and stamps and footy teams and all that stuff. And yet they're often really persecuted. I mean, you think about, you know, in Europe, how many, you know, lions and eagles and stuff are on coat of arms. There hasn't been a lion in that country in millennia, you know?
Totally.
I think we often want to borrow their sort of, you know, regal qualities
right.
and their power
yes.
without having to live alongside them. And I just think that's really sloppy.
Colonial. Yeah. Well,
yeah, 100%.
This is the legacy of how we live and the country that we live in. But it is sloppy.
It is super sloppy. And, you know, Australia is a British colony and Britain has essentially removed all predators. You know, there's no bears, there's no wolves. All eagles in England were killed, you know, and
wow.
are very slowly being reintroduced and not killed a long time ago, killed in the 20th century. The last wild-born eagle in Wales died in 2017 and the last wild-born eagle in Scotland died in around the same time.
Wow.
And the only eagles in the UK, at least of certain breeds, my understanding is they've been repatriated from Scandinavia and they've okay. sort of been slowly been reintroduced.
It's like through like zoos or whatever. Like
yeah, that. through rewilding programs.
Yeah, wow.
So when you think of Australia as a British colony, you know, this is not a new attitude that
no.
these people who sort of founded Australia have had about predatory animals.
Yeah.
You know, they even want to get rid of badgers. What does a badger threaten? You know, chickens, that's about it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that question of why do people do this? I mean, you can go as far back as you want. But as you said, Pia, there's definitely a colonial aspect to it.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think there's something interesting, though, also as translating into photography project, into a book as well.
Mm.
You know, I think the immediacy of your images, I think some of them were also in Australian Geographic recently.
Mm.
You know, this is topical, beautifully shot, like a stunning series of images that translates across so many different forms. And I think that's an incredible skill, Matt. Like I think your attention to detail, your aesthetic, but also that depth of knowledge and research that you've done really inform the work.
Mm.
And it feels like as artists, we have that ability to transcend some of those very traditional barriers, but also speak to so many different audiences. And I think that an incredible power within that particular work, The Killing Sink.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, well done there.
Thank you.
But also, you know, I think what it does speak to is clearly all of your work and even the books that you publish, which I'd love to talk to you about next, I think really have that ability to communicate deep messages, human kind of understandings of the world through a range of different fields. And I think that's very much something that I feel like you're bringing that to the table. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I would absolutely agree. For a lot of reasons, that's important to me. I mean, one, I think a lot of people make art for different reasons, and I don't think there's any better or worse way to be an artist. For me, something that's really important is that what I make has a life with people and hopefully encourages more nuanced thinking, some self-reflection and maybe some questions. I'm not thinking that the images I make are going to change policy or challenge, you know, institutional power or anything huge like that. But what I am really confident of is if someone looks at the book or comes to an exhibition and engages, they might ask themselves a question or think of something in a way that they haven't before.
Yeah.
That's motivating to me. But you don't have to make art that way. I don't want the world to be like Matty Dunn. But to me, like, that's that really important. And I think what's really helpful, what I found with The Killing Sink compared to Patterson's Curse, is because I was following an existing story, so many people that came to exhibitions or engaged with it online or looked at the book, they weren't necessarily people that come to a lot of art shows, but they're people that care about the environment, they're people that care about eagles, they're people that hear about this really awful thing that's happening in Victoria and they want to know more. And when we put on public programs and public talks, we get so many questions, we get so many curious folks wanting to just hear more about what's going on. And that's really important to me, you know, regardless of what the aesthetics are or how well executed it is. It's really important that I can bring some of that knowledge, and some of the like researchers that I work with can come and talk in like different environments to different people. And sometimes that's more important in terms of making the work feel successful, that people are actually talking about the issue rather than Matt's nice picture.
Totally.
Of course, they're both important, but you draw feelings of success from different places sometimes.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I have a very similar feeling with some of my work.
Totally. You know,
yes, it's a nice picture, but the discussion, the conversations afterwards, the translation and impact, I think, of the work, of people thinking about and bringing those issues or concepts into the world is probably way more rewarding than putting on the exhibition,
And I think that translates to some of what Morgana and I choose to publish with Tall Poppy, where we are trying to, like, we get, you know, a lot of engagement with people who show us work or submit to open calls and things like that. And often the projects that we feel the most confident in backing are ones that have a foot both in something that's real and then like a really well done or interesting photographic approach that we can see working in a book.
I think the thing I really love about the Tall Poppy brand, I guess we could call it, you know, independent Melbourne publisher run by yourself and Morgana McGee. You know, I think there's something, every book has something different to offer in a different form. There's no kind of standard style, but as you say, all of the works do speak to kind of real, engaged things and explore them in various different forms. And I think that that's meaningful.
It's definitely meaningful to us. But I think also, just to belabor a point slightly, is like, as a publisher, sometimes a comparison I say is like, you know, like a record label, if you were a classical musician, you know, you wouldn't go to an EDM label. And
totally.
For a lot of reasons. But one of the big reasons is, you know, there are things that I can do well, and then there's lots of other types of art and photography that I'm just not feeling as confident that I can actually bring something to the table. That doesn't mean that that work is bad. It doesn't mean that I don't like it.
No, it just means it's not a good fit for Tall Poppy.
Yeah, because we aren't the right, like, partner.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. And I think
100%.
Also you're putting lots of time, labour, effort, money into it. You need to feel like you're, as you say, adding something but also engaged with the material. Otherwise it's not the right fit.
Definitely not.
Yeah. So how did you move, like, how did you decide the name, firstly? Very Australian, but also to go, hey, yes, I'm going to do this. Like, it's not a small thing.
I'll answer the questions in reverse order.
Okay.
Because I think choosing the start led to the name.
Okay.
So first of all, I'd sort of challenge that it's not a small thing because I started it with very humble goals and I wanted to take very small steps. So, you know, I'd been making books for a long time. I'd done some bookbinding classes. I'd done some bookbinding courses. I'd made a few zines. I'd published The Killing Sink with Void. And I'd wanted to do more book work. And what I'd observed is there are a lot of people who'd sort of started a small publishing press, published their book, their mate's book, their other mate's book, and then run out of friends that have projects and things are kind of fizzled. And yeah. there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it's cool, no dramas. But I didn't want to do that. I sort of thought I wanted to do something that's going to have like a 10-year life, and then I'll decide if it's worth doing for longer.
Okay.
So if the idea isn't good enough for 10 years, then let's take it easy.
Okay.
So the idea of just finding friends that had good work and saying, let's make a book together, it doesn't have legs. Like, it, because what's the angle? What's the sort of container for that? But what the container came is like through a few conversations with people is I'd sort of been writing a lot about Australian photography. I'd been reviewing Australian photography books for a number of websites. And I sort of thought, well, who's the Australian publisher? Yes, there are publishers in Australia, but most of them work with a combination of Australian and international artists, which is great. And I sort of thought, well, maybe my thing is I'm just going to do Australian artists. I'm just going to be a cheerleader for Australian artists. And I'm going to try and do it in a way where there's like as few barriers for the artists that I work with. So we're not going to charge people. We're not going to expect people to contribute towards printing costs if they can't. We're going to try and make something that's like gives a really good deal, even if we can't bring the sort of expertise or distribution networks that sort of like a really mature publisher can. So even if we only do 100 copies, we still want to do a launch. We still want to try and get it reviewed. We still want to photograph it really well. And we want to think of, you know, how can each book we make be really creative and give each artist like a big leg up in their career. And I thought that would be a really good thing to do because it would be satisfying, it would be meaningful for the artists, and it would make me feel proud of that mission. And I think that like one of the nice things about coming to like art and publishing a little bit later in life is I sort of have learned a lot of those lessons from my day job, where projects that you are invested in and you feel like, I know that as this does well, I'll feel good. You realize that you can sustain that and you can keep putting energy in. Whereas projects that are like a good idea, but they don't really mean that much to you, you can't do for that long. So there's lots of good ways to make a publishing company. There's lots of good ways to make a book. But this way was one that I felt would feed me, and I would feel as it succeeded, I would feel successful, and then I would be able to keep going. So I think that it's not like so many advantages to having a day job for like a million reasons.
Yeah.
But one of them is just sort of being able to be a bit more patient. And then Tall Poppy came because I was like, well, it's going to be Australian. It's going to have an Australian name. So, you know, I remember I was chatting to people like, oh, what about like Sugar Glider books, or like, you know, using like some very iconic but maybe like less known Australian animals. And then Tall Poppy Press just felt better because, you know, chip on my shoulder, like Australians are so good at talking about all the things that are bad about Australia. And I just find it so pointless because something I now really believe is like Melbourne in particular is a great place to be a publisher. We have great printers. We have the highest number of independent bookstores per capita in the world. We're a city of literature. We have a lot of really experienced people here that you can just walk into their shop or office and ask for advice, and they'll gladly give it to you. We actually have a lot going for us. And that's just an attitude I have about Australian art in general, is like, we're actually really good, and we should be a little bit less self-conscious about saying like, people make great stuff here. It's world class. And, you know, it deserves a life here. It deserves a life everywhere.
Yeah. I'll back that. That's excellent. Thanks, I agree. Bea.
Yeah.
I think it's really, I think it's interesting that when you're like, oh, it is a small thing, but then you're like, here's my 10-year plan.
Well, it wasn't 10-year plan. It's just like I needed to feel like it could exist.
Yeah.
But like the first book we did, like Rochelle's book.
Yes.
And like forever grateful for Rochelle for taking that first step and like letting me make so many like learnings along the way. Like we did 150 copies. You know, we had a really specific budget. You know, we were making the best book that we can to that budget. And like I didn't spend a ton of money on branding or marketing. You know, I had a free big cartel shop like that linked to PayPal. Like, you know, we put no money into the business at all. you know, everything was hosted on free websites. Everything was through like Instagram, and I don't even think we had a newsletter.
Wow. Like, so everything went into the book.
Yeah, because
that was your thing, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And it was like, you know, now as I've, if I was to start a new business today, you know, I'd probably do it in a different way.
Yeah. But that's okay. I feel like
100%.
I remember
I paid a friend like $50 for the logo, and it's like that logo is going to be with us forever. And
it's
like
a good logo. You got a good friend.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I got a great deal.
But I think, I mean, look, I talk to students about this all the time. You only can be as good as you are right now.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, and you have to value that and actually respect that you brought all the amazing things together that you could do at that time with the knowledge you have, with the money you have, and made the best thing that you could do.
Totally.
And tomorrow you'll do it differently or learn from it, and as you should. But I think we're so, again, thinking about that Australian thing, we go, oh, that was terrible, or we did that really badly, and oh, you know, but actually, no, we did the best we could at the time.
Nobody's ever made anything that they wouldn't change.
Exactly. Right?
But if you wait until you feel
it's like perfect, you'll never do it.
Absolutely not. And also, like, your audience aren't that unforgiving.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
This is something that, you know, when we work with an artist and we publish a book, like, so often I just have to remind people, like, people aren't buying this to hate it. They're buying it because they've already seen it and they love it. Nobody is forcing a photo book purchase on anyone. You know, this isn't.
I wish we could.
Well, maybe, yeah. But it's not like, like, you kind of need electricity in your house. And if your electricity company is kind of jerking you around, you're so screwed.
You don't need a photo book.
But, like, yeah, like, if somebody looks at a book in a store and they choose to buy it,
that's because they really want it.
Yeah. And if they turn out to be slightly disappointed in it, it's like, well, you know, we're not making or breaking anyone's life here.
Totally.
And of course, we don't love that. But generally, like, your audiences.
But it's okay, I think.
It's super okay.
Like, when I buy a photo book, or like, not even buy it, like, just look at one. It's a privilege.
Yeah.
Like, it is this intimate, amazing thing that I'm engaging with that, yeah, some images, they don't resonate. Others, I'm like, oh, my God, I could just fall into this page.
Yeah.
What an amazing experience to be able to give someone.
Totally. And, like, even as a writer, like, I think I've been, like, fairly open in criticizing some books and some artists. And the criticism always comes from a place of, and I try and write this really explicitly, A, this is just my opinion. I'm not trying to, like, make a call about somebody's place in, like, art history. I'm not qualified to do that. Don't want to. But B, the criticism is always, I can see something that I think would be more well executed.
Yeah.
And I don't criticize people on materials or things that would cost money, because I think that that's really unfair. I usually criticize people on, like, this edit's, like, just a bit too big, or, like, I think the inclusion of this writing was just a little bit, like, under-edited.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a tighter, more concentrated thing that could exist here, because that is within your control. Whereas sometimes we've got feedback on our books and people are like, oh, it'd be great if it had this. And we just say, well, we'd need double the budget, and then it'd have to cost $150. So I think I'm really conscious of the fact that, like, your audience is generally on your side.
Mm.
And even when you get criticism, it's usually someone saying, like, this is a 7 out of 10 and I would have, just, I think this could have been a 9 out of 10. And then the times you get criticism that is outside of your control, I actually find that really, like, it's like water off a duck's back. It's like, yeah, of course I'd have loved a $20,000 budget, but I don't have it. But I don't have it. So, like,
yeah, exactly.
What am I going to do? Like,
yeah. And know. Also, too, I think it's that thing where, you know, having the product for that artist means so much more than having the $20,000 budget to have it as the slightly different product in some ways, too. Like, for me, I think as an artist, like, I would prefer to have had the opportunity to make the book. Haven't made a book. But, like, let's say I'm totally scared. I'm very, yeah, I've said this to a number of people. I'm not ready yet. But, like, I'd prefer to have the exhibition and not have the photos framed, for example.
Totally.
Rather than not have the exhibition because I couldn't do it because they had to be framed.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. I think the offering there, the invites there, the work is out in the world. I keep going back to this idea of being in the world. But that to me is so much more important as an artist, to start the conversations, to start thinking, to contribute.
Yeah.
Then go, oh, no, I'm going to turn that offer down because I didn't get the funding.
Totally. I think, you know, like, we could all learn more from, like, street artists. And, like, people that just slap posters up. Doesn't mean you have to do that, but just think about
performance
how.
Performance artists, people that have a temporal form in public. I mean, amazing, right?
Yeah, and like, you can still have so much impact, even if, like, you're knocking at doors and people are saying no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, cool. You also now run bookmaking workshops. I've seen you on Insta doing like one day books, and again, I find it utterly fascinating. I love books. I have lots of books, as I said, very scared. What's your favorite process?
I love the sewing.
Oh, as in the like the binding.
Yeah. So with and I'm not a perfectionist. So people that watch me bind, you know, bookmaking is a really interesting thing because it has a history as a craft and as an industrial process. So it attracts a lot of perfectionists. Fair enough. I'm not a perfectionist. I find perfectionism is just like anxiety parading as productivity, but it's not helpful.
Yeah, I'm one of those.
Whoops.
Sorry.
Sorry, thinly veiled. So, you know, often when people see me bind, experienced book binders are like, oh, you know, your stitching is like not like razor sharp. And that doesn't interest me to be razor sharp. It interests me, as you said, to make things and enjoy the making. So for books, I mean, like, if I make a book in a day, for example, you know, you've got playing with your photos, making the files, printing it, binding it. And my favorite part is binding with sewing. So with binding, you can bind through folding, gluing, and sewing. That's sort of the main ways you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to have things that they like a little bit more or a little bit less. When I learned to sew and make books, something about that process I just enjoy a lot more than folding. You know, folding, you really do need to be a perfectionist or it doesn't come together. And gluing is fine, but the sewing, I think, is really absolutely my favorite. I love sewing. Maybe trimming. When you get a really clean trim, it just you're like ooh.
That sounds like the perfectionist moment.
Yeah, but you get a guillotine. The guillotine does
it. The guillotine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting you say that about the sewing. I have to admit, I come from a sewing, like a textile background.
Yeah.
And I do really enjoy a book that has beautiful sewing, or the stitching is like
visible. Yeah,
100%. Yeah. There's something really lovely about
it. It's nice when an object owns its materiality. Something
totally.
That I find really uninspiring about some artist books is they don't the object. This is going to sound so obnoxious, but like the object is agnostic towards being an object. It's like trying to be a gallery, trying to be a wall, but it's not paper. It has a weight. It has a texture that you feel. And books are, you know, they're inherently sequential generally. They're one of the few art forms that you have to touch. You know, if you go to, an exhibition, you don't
you're
always.
You're not meant to touch.
No, and that's fine. Yeah. Like, you know, touching something and reducing its archival properties, I mean, it's kind of a travesty. With a book, you don't have to worry about that. So sometimes you pick up an object and you think this person just wanted a portfolio or an exhibition.
Mm.
And I prefer things that are really textural, like are made very attentively to like the feel of it in the hand. So it's good that I'm a publisher.
I was going to say it is good that you're a publisher. But also too, you make a lot of books that you can fit in your hand, like small books.
Small books are underrated.
Like it's quite amazing. You know, I've got lots of big photo books and they're stunning, but like they're a pain to handle.
Oh, mate, when I run a workshop, one of the activities I do in almost every workshop is I let people into the library. And I just say like pick a few books that you like the format of. Like try and ignore the material and try and find books that you like the format of. And so many people, honestly, seriously, like 60 or 70% of people in that activity bring back a small book. And when I say which book did you choose and why, so many folks are like, you know, I wasn't expecting to like this book, but it is so easy to use. It's so easy to look through. I love how it sits in my hand. And I can see all the images because people's worry with smaller books sometimes is that their work is not going to get the space that it needs. And, of course, if you go super small, like a matchbox.
Oh, yeah, sure. But like.
Totally. But yeah. Actually, like, people can just move a book closer to their face. And they do. And yes. And often that's really nice seeing people.
Oh, my God, that's so true.
Yeah, like it's when you're at a book fair or something and someone picks up a book and they're really peering into it.
It's a lovely thing to watch.
Yeah, because you're like, this person is immersed. Whereas like a big book that you have to have on a table
is
cumbersome.
Yeah, or the big fold-outs, which are very fashionable in the last 10 years.
Yeah, the gatefolds, 100%.
They're huge. And you're like, this is stunning, but also like
how do I fold it back? And it's really awkward and I'm going to tear the page.
And then you talk to bookstores and they're like, we
hate them, right?
Hate's maybe a strong word. They feel really nervous about them because they're easily damaged.
Yeah.
And then that's not good for anyone. Yeah. Which is not to say don't make things that are big or don't make gatefolds, but just that I do have a preference for smaller books because I'm a bit of an intimacy nerd. Like I just want things to feel like super close.
Yeah.
And the other nice thing is when you make a small book, because your material costs are lower, you can often afford some nicer options in terms of things like gatefolds.
Okay. Yeah.
So, for example, with Morgana's second book, like the printing, it's so much black. We used a more expensive paper and cover paper. And then we also have quite a lot of gatefolds, which if the book was double or triple the size.
You couldn't afford it, right?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of reasons that they're cheaper to ship.
Yeah, totally.
They're more economical. I mean, someone like me that's obsessed with the environment, publishing is not a hugely environmentally friendly or environmentally destructive industry. It's not a big enough industry really to be of super concern, but I do think it behooves us to use less where we can and really challenge ourselves. Do we need 25 centimeters when maybe 19 will be more than enough?
Yeah.
Yeah,
great.
You don't have to answer this, but I want to know if you have a favorite all-time photo book.
I have a couple. So the one that I would most often go back to is a book called Disco Night 9/11. It's by a photographer called Peter Van Achtmael. And I'll tell you what it's about and then I'll tell you why I love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter Van Achtmael, when he graduated college, it was sort of the start of the war on terror. And then he essentially, if I remember the story correctly, sort of talked his way into becoming a war photographer. So he didn't really have any background in journalism. Again, I'm sorry if I'm misremembering some of these small details. And he spent the next 10 years photographing in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq. And the book is sort of this story of him starting, feeling like I'm going on an adventure. I'm going to go see this big, like, globally important thing. And by the end of the book, he's like, I am ruined. All these people that I've spent time with, local Afghanis, local Iraqis, soldiers, their lives are devastated. So why I love it so much is like it's a really well, like it's a very open journey where someone's gone from being sort of like a young and dumb 23-year-old to being a sort of like almost like regretful and sort of kind of hurt person. Mm. And I think he owns that really beautifully in the work and it has some really great uses of captions. The last image is of this veteran who, you know, had horrific injuries and then sort of became a comedian as a way of trying to, you know, find a second line of work. And the last image in the book that I can remember at least, it's this guy floating in a pool and the caption says, you know, Bobby told me he often thinks of death and wish that he'd died instead of surviving. He worries every day about being a burden on his family. And it's just like the book ends.
Wow.
And it's like tears in my eyes, like every time I'm crying. And I don't know, I just think that that's, you know, especially for like a young man, especially like the young man I was, that's such a relatable trajectory of going from sort of like a naive excitement to a like more seasoned like regret. And the geopolitics just makes the story even more.
Yeah, of course.
So that's great. I mean, I think it's a masterclass in sequencing.
Wow. Okay. I need to find it.
Yeah. The other one that I really love is almost completely different. It's called The Missing Eye.
Okay.
I would say it's a book about nothing. Okay. The artists, I think, would disagree with me because I've read their press release. They say it's a book about imagining what blind people might see, but it's this sort of thing where it's a book between two artists and it sort of just like mines their archives. Like it's not a project that was conceived from the start. It's a book that sort of puts their work in conversation with each other. You don't know who took which photo, and it has just these really unusual, at times jarring, but very masterful like pages where images that you would never put together normally, they don't have anything seemingly in common, are just put. And it's so impressive. Like, you think about how do you edit something so it feels cohesive and jarring. The work seems to have no consistent theme, but the book is really, like I said, cohesive. I'm just so impressed with it. I love every page. It's stunning, and it's hard. It's like, it's so hard to edit a pile of pictures that don't have a spine, don't have a narrative, don't have a thing that you're trying to do with them, to just look at them as images and let them do something interesting and inventive as images without any context is the hardest thing to do for me. So I just really respect how well it's done, and the photos are fantastic.
Yeah, cool. And what's next, either for you individually or for Tall Poppy Press?
Well, Tall Poppy Press is in a kind of a growth at the moment. So in July last year, my manager called me and said, hey, we're not getting enough funding for me to keep you on at this job anymore.
This is the day job.
This was my day job. And I'd sort of been chomping at the bit to maybe work for myself, but the plan was to maybe give it another year.
Mm-hmm. So you got the catalyst to do this.
Yeah, I started looking at other jobs and I just thought, I don't want to apply for anything. So I sort of said to my partner, I said, do you mind, can I just try this for 6 months? Like, would it be, would it make you stressed? And I think she said something along the lines of like, just have a crack. I said, if it gets to 6 months and it's not working, that's fine.
Yeah,
I'll go back to work. No worries. But I got to the end of last year and I sort of thought, oh, we're maybe almost at the point. Like, it's not 100% like I'm making enough money, but I'm not that far away. So this year is a year where, like, either we will make enough money from book sales and workshop sales and, you know, we're updating our, like, branding and marketing and all that sort of stuff, where I just keep doing this and workshops and stuff as my full-time job. Or it'll be the time where I sort of go, hey, you know, I use that period of time to really upgrade what we're doing, have to go back to full-time work. But I'm really proud of, like, what I was able to, you know, improve and upgrade in that.
And you'll keep
time.
Going, right?
Oh, 100%. Good. Maybe slower. But
where are
but
you up to in that 10-year plan?
This is the fourth year.
Okay. Cool.
So we have some plans for our fifth year. We're thinking we might do some, I don't want to reveal them, but because the person might be like, that was more like a conversation rather than like an agreement. But there's something that I'd really like to do for our fifth year anniversary, but we'll see if it happens. So what's next for Tall Poppy is we're really trying to put out the best books that we can with the extra time and experience.
Amazing.
And also trying to take more advantage of opportunities to go to fairs, sell more directly and improve what we're doing.
Great.
Doing a lot more workshops this year. I really want Melbourne and Australia to continue to grow as like a centre for bookmaking. I think the way that I can contribute to that is to help people find ways to look at bookmaking as a fun, enjoyable, creative activity and to remove some of that anxiety and fear about putting a book out in the world.
Sure. I promise I will come to one of your workshops.
Great. But in general, I think, you know, I think something I bring from my day job, which used to be a high school teacher and then a university teacher, is like, if you're on your own, it's so easy to feel overwhelmed and intimidated by the process of actually seeing something through.
Mm.
I believe that regardless of where someone's at, whether they just want to make a small publication, make a book by hand or put out a larger run, I can help them feel more confident, more comfortable, more prepared, make fewer mistakes and succeed. I want everyone that comes to a workshop who makes a book to be able to make a better book that succeeds without stressing out or spending a ton of money, because that's how, in my opinion, how I can help the scene continue to grow, as opposed, in addition to just publishing like 4 or 5 books a year.
Yeah.
What's next for me? Man, I've been working on this project about dingoes. Dingoes are the most persecuted animals in Australia. The world's largest environmental barrier exists in Australia. It's the world's largest fence. It's longer than the Great Wall of China, and it exists entirely to exclude dingoes from one part of the country so that they can all be killed, and then the other part of the country is too arid for us to grow anything, so no one cares about it.
Wow.
And it's an insane story, and it's like there's just this huge fence that runs through the middle of the country that you could drive by and not know. That's 5,500 kilometres long. So I've been looking at dingoes, the dingo-proof fence, how dingoes are controlled through guns, through shooting, through trapping, why we do this, trying to get a bit closer to the animal. Like, we talk so much about it. There are so many policies about it, and yet very few people have actually seen one or encountered one. And I'm exhibiting a lot this year, and then next year I'm going to put out a book. It's going to be a long, crazy book. There's going to be screenshots. There's going to be photos. There's going to be scanned books. It's going to be a bit of a multimedia extravaganza. So the designer I'm working with is excited, and also I think we're both a bit like, what the fuck are you doing?
Oh, I'm really excited.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited too. I feel like I was hoping to put it out this year, but then I realized there's just a few more things I wanted to shoot. And there's so much travel involved. I got to drive for like 2 days before I take one photo. It sucks.
I love it. Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Great.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leadovitz.